It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. As COVID-19 continues to spread around the world, including the U.S., our guest says we should still pay attention to the threat of flu here in Wisconsin. We'll get the latest on both illnesses coming up. First, a civil conversation with someone you might disagree with has gotten tougher to come by, it seems. Between our growing political divide and the nature of social media, it's easy to think that everyone's always angry with each other. For the last year, our next guests have been working to dial down the temperature through their work with the Local Voices Network. The project, which launched in Wisconsin last year, gets small groups of people together around a digital recorder to talk about their values, viewpoints, and the issues most important to them, with the goal of understanding each other and ourselves a bit better. Parisa Parsa is the CEO of Cortica, the nonprofit organization operating the Local Voices Network. Parisa, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Colleen Butler is the capacity building lead for Cortica and leader of the Wisconsin chapter of the Local Voices Network. Colleen, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Parisa, the Local Voices Network has been operating for, I think, about a year now. What was the catalyst? What got this project started?
Sure. We were started out of the Laboratory for Social Machines at the MIT Media Lab, which had been doing a whole bunch of work on analyzing the patterns of communication and the increasingly polarized and divisive patterns of communication by tracking Twitter and talk radio streams over the period leading up to the 2016 election, and watching unfold what we now take for granted as this growing divide and the increasing speed and breadth of transmission of false news as opposed to true, deep, real experiences of individuals, and started to ask, can we create a way to analyze the patterns of what happens with people in real conversations, in person, in small groups, going deep, in the same way that we can analyze these Twitter and talk radio streams? And can we shift the tide to a healthier public sphere by catalyzing those conversations and building them at scale? So with the help of Kathy Kramer, a political scientist and researcher at the University of Wisconsin, we got started in Wisconsin.
And Colleen, as we just heard, Wisconsin was part of the story behind this. Bring us into a conversation that you might lead or one of your facilitators might lead here in Wisconsin. If I'm participating, what's it going to look like to me?
Yeah, well, the fun thing about the conversations is that all of them are quite different. And we have conversations in Madison that are with young people from a variety of different backgrounds speaking about their experience as immigrants or as people who have experienced homelessness. We've had conversations in Wapaka with people who are farmers and talking about kind of their concerns around flooding. We're about to start having conversations in Sauk County, which will be focused on small farms and the impact of tariffs. So, you know, every community has different groups of people who are coming together, and then the issues that come up very much reflect what's happening in that community at that moment.
And Parisa, I think it's really easy to get a group of people together in person or online and have a really bad conversation, a really negative, hostile, unproductive one. What do you and your facilitators do to make sure that it doesn't devolve?
Yeah, we have some guiding principles for our conversations that are really important for providing the structure to really remind folks of the skills we always already carry with us and just aren't always encouraged to use quite as much. So first is we invite people to introduce themselves by naming a guiding value that represents why they're even in the conversation, right? So connecting on the level of values. And then all of our questions, from the introductory questions to the questions about what's happening in the community, invite folks to share not an opinion or a position on an issue, or if they share the position on the issue, to share it by way of a personal experience that informs their way of thinking or relating to the issue. And by rooting it in both values and personal experience, we invite a broader telling of the story of what's happening for the individual and for the community. And folks really can invite each other's compassion and understanding, even if they don't agree about the issue.
Colleen, this isn't something we sit down routinely and do anymore, if we ever did. What's the reaction you get from people when you see them kind of embrace this conversation?
You know, it's been really remarkable. It's often difficult to get people to come into the conversation because people are like, well, we're going to talk for 90 minutes. And what's it about and why and what's going to happen with this information and what's this new technology? You know, there's a lot of questions. But then once people do actually sit down for the 90 minutes and make connections with their neighbors, with their coworkers, with people that they haven't met in their community before, at this level of sharing stories, I've just been really amazed by the vulnerability that people have in the conversations and the compassion that develops throughout the conversations. And so people oftentimes at the end are like, we want to do more of this. We want to come back for another one. How do we stay, you know, connected? And so I feel like our best kind of marketing strategy is getting people to come to a conversation. And once that has happened, people are really excited and engaged because I think people are missing that feeling of connection a lot of the time.
Talking to Colleen Butler and Parisa Parso with Cortica, the nonprofit organization operating what we're talking about, the Local Voices Network. Parisa, Colleen just mentioned the technology. Introduce us to the electric hearth.
Sure. The digital hearth is a device that we are making by hand in our offices right now. Limited supply offers an 8 microphone array to record the conversations, and it's a warm, beautiful object to have at the center of the conversation. It has in it a mini hard drive, a Raspberry Pi, that has on it the capacity to hold the conversation data that's recorded, as well as data from other conversations that are curated, and helps us to share voices from another conversation into the conversation you're having in the room. Once the conversations are recorded on the digital hearth, they're uploaded to our software platform that helps us to visualize the conversation. So they're transcribed and there's audio and text analysis on the platform that allows you to see who spoke when and for how long, what keywords came up multiple times in the conversation, and for all participants allows full visibility to the conversation they took part in and any other conversations in their collection of conversations. And there's the possibility then of going in and what we call curating, choosing highlights or important quotes from the conversation that folks would really like to have shared beyond their conversation, either into other conversations for folks to respond to, or eventually we'll be able to just tweet these right out and hopefully share some of the healthy, more nuanced and complexifying views out into that sphere that's been known for the thin stories that we can tell about each other and the knee-jerk responses.
Colleen, are people reluctant at all with the, you know, knowing that they're sitting in front of this 8 microphone funky recorder?
It depends. Sometimes people are. I think the thing that's nice about it is Parisa kind of talked about it. It's intentionally designed to be kind of like a piece of furniture, mm-hmm. so it doesn't look like your phone's in the middle of the table, and so and there's a light underneath it that glows when it's recording. So that's intended to remind people that it is in fact there. It is in fact recording, because obviously if we're recording, we want anybody to only share things that they're comfortable having recorded. So once the conversation gets underway, people usually get fairly comfortable around it. And but we try really hard at the beginning to make sure everybody knows it's going to be recorded before they even come into the room. So some of that, anxiety can be dissipated.
Parisa, part of this is the opportunity for the actual participants themselves to have this kind of conversation that might be hard to come by. But you're also hoping that we in the media, that maybe policymakers can make use of this. How so?
Right. Well, we know that it's an increasingly huge problem that contributes to our polarization, that there is not the level of beat reporting or the ability for journalists to be, you know, embedded in communities in the same way that they once were. And so local journalism has really suffered. And so we're hoping to fuel journalism with access to more stories than are easy to come by, given the current strapped resource environment, and to be able to access a deeper complexity of stories. categories and to be able to see the breadth of what people are talking about in a different way. And by giving the participants access to the platform, we're hoping that, especially as we work with community groups that are trying to understand how to surface needs in meaningful ways to policymakers, that we can kind of complete that arc by sharing the public perception and experiences with the media and with policymakers to inform and create a different kind of accountability. It's harder to ignore recorded conversations that are available to the public than it is to sort of nod your head at a town meeting and hope it's over soon. So, and we're seeing actually that policymakers are really eager to have this kind of engagement and this kind of deeper understanding of what's happening. And that's already happening in Madison.
We're talking to Parisa Parsa and Colleen Butler, both with the Local Voices Network, which was launched last year in Wisconsin, a handful of communities around the state, and a few around the country as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we need more discussions aimed at simply understanding each other and our views on important issues? Are you able to have this kind of conversation in your community, maybe with people you might not always agree with, but it doesn't spiral into name-calling? How do these conversations go? Are you worried about what happens if we don't have these interactions? And do you have a question about the Local Voices Network itself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Parisa Parsa and Colleen Butler of the Local Voices Network. They host small group conversations in Wisconsin and other states about local and national issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a space in your community, your family, your workplace, I don't know, for these kind of discussions? How do you approach a conversation with people who might have different viewpoints than your own? Do you have conversations with people who have different viewpoints than your own? Do you have questions about the Local Voices Network, what they're doing, whether they might be coming to a community near you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that how important this is to get people to talk with people who have different views, simply because the mainstream media doesn't really go towards people of differing views for which their newscast seems to be oriented. An example would be immigration. If you are a left-leaning newscast, if someone does not support open borders, it's easier to call them in a soundbite racist than to really explore the issues. Conversely, if you're on one of the more conservative newscasts, they will sit there and say, there's an increase in crime, but not recognize the policies of the United States that's leading people to come to this country illegally. Something like this is so necessary that for people to see what the true issues are and that there are two sides to the coin. Thank you.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Parisa, Charlie talking about what some people call the, you know, a media bubble, an information bubble where people hear stuff they agree with and can then condemn the things they disagree with.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to counteract. And I think that one of the add-on effects of only hearing those kinds of sound bites that are the extreme is that we forget that we are complicated people who have intersecting issues that play out in our lives. And one of the things that these small group conversations allow is for a fullness of the telling of our story that I think is really critical to opening up the conversation beyond those polarized and really narrow stories.
Thanks for that call, Charlie, at 800-642-1234. And Colleen, seeing these conversations and hearing them in person, I think a lot of times we might be quick to categorize people, you know, politically, we know they're on this side, so they therefore think this thing. When you hear people actually talk, though, does it get more complicated and nuanced than that?
Yeah, I think it definitely does get more complicated and nuanced. You know, one of the things, as Parisa said earlier, that we really focus on is trying to get people to share stories from their personal experience. And one of the examples that I use when we're doing our facilitator training is that when you hear me say, like, I believe healthcare is a human right. You either agree or you disagree, and you're getting into your position to, you know, either argue or go along with it. Whereas if I tell you a story about my family and my father-in-law who has Alzheimer's and, you know, the ways in which his needs have not been met, even though he did everything he was supposed to do, you know, you're leaning in a little bit more. And that's where the complexity and the nuance comes in, that you have people, instead of kind of getting in their corners, they're leaning into each other and understanding better, like, why it is they have the perspectives that they have.
Let's bring on another caller now. Arthur joins us from Toma. Arthur, hello.
Hi there.
What'd you want to bring up, Arthur?
Well, so I found it interesting. What if this were brought to scale and tens of thousands of conversations were to be happening? How could we use machine learning and artificial intelligence to sort of surface the highlights or the most talked about features at a national or an international level?
Arthur, thanks for the call. Parisa, that's part of what you're trying to do, right?
That's exactly what we're trying to do. So, we're actively expanding. We've got chapters now in Boston, New York City, Birmingham, Alabama, and the starts of plans in Sacramento, California, and Charlotte, North Carolina. And we're aiming at just that. We're dealing all the time with the challenges that we really think that there's a great power for machine learning and artificial intelligence to help us better understand and track the patterns of the deeper connections that we make. And we're out to try to prove that.
Yeah, what kind of things potentially could we discover, Parisa, by using those techniques?
Well, we're looking at one of the challenges to scale is that a lot of this stuff really does require the human understanding better the human perceptions and the ways that we train ourselves to listen for different things and listen along different channels. And so Kathy Kramer and others at the Lab for Social Machines are actively helping us to trace the patterns of influence among people in conversations, as well as the kinds of weighted emotional words that folks use to describe their feelings, and track those across conversations to understand better, you know, how often are folks talking about marriage, for instance, as a positive thing, and what does it take for those patterns of influence to spread? We can see them really easily on Twitter because it's text-based and it moves really fast across networks, and trying to trace human voices and the ways that people nuance their communication is the next big hurdle. So it's long-term work, but it's pretty exciting to understand how we communicate and how we can communicate more effectively across difference.
Talking about the Local Voices Network with Parisa Parsa and Colleen Butler for the nonprofit Cortico. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I would like to get your response to this, please. It seems to me what we're actually suffering from for many, many generations now is the fact that the basic logical fallacies of argument under a topic called rhetoric simply isn't taught anymore. If you want to learn about it, you have to go to law school. People can't distinguish between a good and a really lousy argument. They don't know what begging the question is. They don't know what a non sequitur is, an ad hominem argument, ignoring the question, or the slippery slope, or the straw man, or the red
Marcus,
herring.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. I see where you're going. But Colleen, you're not really looking for rhetorical debate and argument in these settings, are you?
That's right. Yeah, we're really not. It's definitely possible that conflict can arise in the conversations, but we're really trying to actually create a space where people are not trying to persuade each other towards a particular viewpoint, but instead are really sharing from their own experience and stories and learning more about each other. And so moving away from that more polarized state.
And Colleen, I wanted to talk about the training of the facilitator here, because that seems like it's going to be such a huge part of making this successful.
Yeah.
What goes into teaching someone how to maintain this kind of space?
Yeah, thank you. So I think, as Parisa mentioned earlier, we have a couple of different conversation principles that really help create the space for people to participate from a place of sharing their personal experience rather than kind of engaging in argument. I think what we try to do in the facilitator training is really focus on the kinds of questions you can use as a facilitator to bring things back to the local and the personal. We also talk about strategies to navigate conflict either within the group or if you yourself as a facilitator are having your buttons pushed in the moment, you know, how do you know that about yourself and handle that in the moment? So those are some of the things. And then, of course, there's the logistics of just learning the conversation framework that we have and the how to use all of the technology.
Now, Parisa, suppose somebody in the media is listening or a local policymaker is listening and saying, I would love to hear what people are talking about and how they're talking about these issues. How can they join in and get a taste of what's going on here?
Well, we welcome them joining. We can offer a demo of the whole product and an opportunity to listen to some of the conversations that are already in the collection. And we're actively looking for both media and public official or public sector partners who are interested in helping us understand what can make the platform most useful for them. So reach out to us at cortico.ai or lvn.org, and we'll be glad to make the connection.
And Colleen, for people around Wisconsin thinking, yeah, I want to play, how can they get involved and sit around the digital hearth?
Yeah, the best thing would be to go to lvn.org. And then if you go to the Wisconsin page, you'll find our contact information, but you'll also find conversations that are on the calendar that you can register for. So if you want to get involved in a conversation, that would be great. And then that's our first step for people becoming facilitators, as well as you participate in a conversation first, and then we can get you signed up to facilitate if you're interested.
That's pretty straightforward. I just pulled it up while you were talking. LVN.org is the website.
Correct.
Well, Colleen, thank you so much for coming up today.
Thank you.
And Parisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Parisa Parsa is the CEO of Cortico, the nonprofit group behind the Local Voices Network. Colleen Butler is head of the network's Wisconsin chapter. They talked with us about the group's work hosting and recording civil conversations between people of different backgrounds about the values that shape their thinking and their personal experiences as well. Again, if you want to join in and check it out, the website is lvn.org for Local Voices Network. Coming up after the news, we'll get an update on COVID-19 and the ongoing risk of influenza here in Wisconsin and get some advice on how to avoid both. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we dig into the impact of climate change on Wisconsin-grown and made foods, including potatoes. First, Italy has placed about 16 million people in central and northern provinces under quarantine to help contain the spread of COVID-19. That includes cities like Milan and Venice. Schools, museums, nightclubs, and other venues there are closed nationwide. The measures, said to be the most extreme outside of China, will stay in effect until April 3rd. More than 7,300 cases have been confirmed in Italy, resulting in more than 350 deaths. Worldwide, there have been 109,000 cases in 95 countries. Here in the U.S., we've had nearly 550 cases in 34 states, only one so far in Wisconsin, though. Our next guest says that while we're watching for that illness, we should focus on the flu season still going on here in the state. Brenda Klon is an infection preventionist with SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital, Janesville. Brenda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's set coronavirus aside for a moment. We'll talk about that in a bit. Flu is not necessarily in the headlines as much, but it is in your personal headlines, right?
Absolutely. For people in Wisconsin right now, I am much more concerned about influenza. We have been seeing very, very high numbers of influenza in Wisconsin.
And is it tapering off now? I've heard there were two different flus and we're kind of on the second one now.
Yeah, so there's it's different strains of the flu. It's the A strain and the B strain. And actually, we're still seeing high numbers of both. I just ran our reports this morning, and we still have A's and B's out there.
And the vaccine levels, what do we know about how many people have gotten vaccinated this year for influenza?
Last count, I don't recall because I've been that hasn't been hot on my radar, but
sure.
I do know our numbers are really lower than we would like to see. I mean, it's a vaccine-preventable disease. It may not cover the strain 100%, but it most certainly might impact the severity of your illness if you've gotten that vaccine.
And I've seen, and I think you may have been quoted saying something like this, we're really eager for a coronavirus vaccine. We have an influenza vaccine that people aren't necessarily lining up to get, even though it is a known and predictable risk.
You're right. I actually did say that. You know, so, I mean, if we had a vaccine for coronavirus, I believe that we would have people lined up to get it. And they're not lining up like that to get the flu vaccine.
Talking to Brenda Klain, infection preventionist with SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital in Janesville, looking at this year's flu season and the possible risk of coronavirus. Brenda, let's talk about what we can do as individuals for flu and coronavirus if and when it comes to Wisconsin. What is some of our basic don't spread the germs hygiene that we should be thinking about?
You know, it's some of the same basic things that we talk about all the time. First of all, try to avoid close contact with people who are sick. When you're sick, stay home. Avoid touching your eyes, your nose, your mouth. Cover your cough with a tissue and then throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Hand sanitizer, it's really great that people want hand sanitizer. However, there's nothing wrong with soap and water. That was the very first way we started washing our hands before we had the convenience of the hand sanitizer. Soap and water works fine when you're in a house or in a building that has a sink and has plumbing. The hand sanitizer is handy when you're traveling or when you're not at home and you can wash your hands. So I guess I really wouldn't panic and worry that, the hand sanitizer is being is not available right now. And the other thing, for people who are hoarding it, just word to the wise, there is an expiration date on your hand sanitizer. It's not going to last forever either. So it's not something that you need to go and buy hundreds of bottles.
On that hoarding issue, I've seen at least some anecdotal cases of people saying, yeah, I've got somebody at home who just had surgery. We need to do some wound care. And I go to the stores and people have cleaned out, the gloves. Or there are other critical supplies that people are stocking up on that may not need them. And that may keep them out of the hands of the people who already do need them. Is that a concern you have?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing that in healthcare and in other venues out there, like our EMS districts, our fire districts, police districts. They're not able to all get the supplies that they're needed because people are hoarding them. And there isn't really a need to do that. Is what will happen if we start seeing it, and you're hearing about this in other countries. I just heard about it, in Italy, where they're telling people to stay in place. If we had huge pockets of stuff, we might want people to stay at home. But hoarding the gloves and the hand sanitizer isn't going to be helpful at home if you're being asked to stay at home. But hand sanitizer, soap and water, that works well. I've been seeing some news articles about some homemade hand sanitizer, which would be appropriate if you needed that if you were going to be traveling. But again, soap and water. When you're using the bathroom, when you're at home, soap and water.
Now, on the front lines, it seems like our healthcare providers, hospitals, and senior centers, all places where the people who might be the most vulnerable to a respiratory illness like coronavirus, like flu, what are we doing? What do we need to do in these kind of institutions to protect the people who might be most at risk for these illnesses?
If you're ill, don't go to them, because then you could spread those viruses. And I understand if it's your loved one and you want to see them, but you're not doing them or any of the other patients or residents in those facilities, you're not doing them any good if you're going in there when you're ill.
Now let's get into the coronavirus a little bit. As we said, it's not a thing here in Wisconsin yet, but looking at something like this on the horizon, what do healthcare providers do to prepare for that if and when it gets here scenario?
Well, I mean, we've been researching. We've been paying attention to what's going on out there. We have plans set up in place in our hospitals and in our clinics. You will be screened when you come in. We're going to screen you for travel. We're going to see if you've had any known history of an exposure to somebody with the COVID-19, and if you're symptomatic. Those questions we ask upon entry into our hospitals and our clinics. And if you have had those travel history and symptomatic, you're going to get isolated right away until we can evaluate you further.
Let's talk about capacity of our healthcare system a little bit, because just because a new disease comes along doesn't mean everything else stops. We'll still have the things that people might go to a hospital for anyway, injuries, chronic conditions, things like that. A new illness is just above and beyond that. Is there a worry that if this thing comes and hits places in Wisconsin that, you know, hospitals might be overwhelmed?
That is always a possibility. I was around back when we had H1N1 about, a little over 10 years ago. I remember very well that was a concern back then. Hospitals have prepared a lot in the last 10, 11 years. We've learned a lot. We have something called surge capacity policies. So, yeah, if it would hit super hard, we would have plans in place of, canceling elective things, triaging our patients, and having things set up so that we could take care if we had an increased surge of patients.
It sounds like you and honestly anybody else in public health I've talked to is, concerned, watching for this coronavirus. I'm not hearing a panic. Is that fair to say?
I'm not panicked about it. I mean, it is a disease. Coronavirus, just so you know, coronavirus, while it got called coronavirus to start with, coronavirus has been a virus that's been around for a long time. Most of the time, the coronavirus is just a basic cold. Most people aren't hospitalized for it. It's because this is a new strain of it, and so we're not sure how it's going to act and how people are going to be affected by it. So that's why we're paying close attention to it. Of concern over in China, initial reports were that there was an increased percentage of people were dying from it than we would have expected from the regular coronavirus. We've had other coronaviruses out there before. We've had MERS that happened in about 2014, along with Ebola. And then we also had SARS. That was, I think, around 2003, 2004, where we had that. And those were both coronaviruses as well. So this isn't our first coronavirus that we've been dealing with.
Now, we're watching news coming out of places like Seattle, where there are, more confirmed cases, some confirmed deaths. And we're seeing this idea of social distancing, the idea of, when you can limit your exposure to crowds and especially to sick people, or if you're sick, limiting your exposure to someone else. Is that a strategy that might be part of what we do here in Wisconsin, again, if and when this novel coronavirus strain comes to the state?
If we started seeing increased numbers here, that might be some of the recommendations that you may see. You may see some events canceled, some large events. I've seen on the news, like some basketball games and some sporting events, they might limit those and not have fans in there because, again, you're in close quarters and, people all around you. And if one person comes and doesn't stay home when they're ill, it could infect a whole bunch of people.
And Britta, just in our last few minutes, we've got the cold, the flu, and the novel coronavirus, all respiratory conditions. As an individual, I might be worried and want to seek medical help, but I don't want to overwhelm the system with something that is just, a cold or a mild flu. When should people be thinking about calling their doctor's office?
Usually we tell people, first of all, you're right, all of them are respiratory, so it could be cough, fever, sore throat. Influenza ends up having a few more body aches and headaches with it than the coronavirus and colds, so that's a little bit of a difference. Most certainly, if you're concerned, if we feel like you're dehydrated, if you're not peeing, if you're not able to take enough fluids in, if you're just feeling like you can't get by, absolutely. Minor cough and cold, wait it out a day or two, as long as you're eating and drinking okay. But then, you know, always, if you don't want to come in, you can place a call to your doctor. There's a lot of e-visits out there where you can call in and see people electronically. You know, take care of some of that. Call your doctor. Talk to them on the phone and see if they have other recommendations for you.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Brenda Klain, infection preventionist with SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital, Janesville, with the latest on influenza and coronavirus. Coming up, a look at climate change and how it affects key Wisconsin food products. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, oil prices have dropped a lot in a fight between two of the world's biggest oil producers. So what does it all mean for consumers and for Wisconsin's energy sector? We'll get answers from a Midwestern energy analyst coming up. First, unless you're a farmer in Wisconsin's Central Sands region, you might not be as familiar with its status as a potato powerhouse. The wet, sandy soil there has historically been a good growing environment for the thirsty crop. But wetter seasons and more severe temperature swings associated with climate change have been hurting the crop and increasing the risk of nitrate pollution in groundwater. Mary Kate McCoy is a digital content producer for WPR. She reported on the ways climate change is impacting a variety of Wisconsin food products in a new series called On the Table. Mary Kate, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig deep into potatoes here, I want to talk about this big series you've got going on, climate change and how it affects these iconic Wisconsin food products. What was the inspiration for this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So really, it came from me just thinking just about climate change in general and how big and how overarching of a thing that is and how it affects everything. And I was just trying to find ways that, you know, how can I tell the story that's in a relatable, kind of approachable way? And that's where I came to food, because who doesn't love to eat and who, you know, food has such like a cultural tie. So it kind of just all snowballed from there.
Before we go into one particular food, it seems like one running theme is that each of these food products has its own unique issues, concerns, and problems. Climate change is just one of them that can contribute to these other issues. Can you talk about that as an overarching theme?
Yeah. So one thing I kind of heard over and over from the researchers that I talked to is that, like you said, climate change isn't the only thing that's affecting these foods, but it's pervasive. It is affecting all of them and in unique and different ways and in kind of some unexpected ways. So some of them for example, cranberries, like it's really affected by warming winters. Something like, you know, cheese, which comes from cows, which need crops to be fed, right? That is really the intense rains are really kind of affecting those crops and making that connection and whatnot. So like there's different angles and different things that are affecting all of these, but like none of these foods can escape climate change and what's changing.
Let's get into potatoes. People think Wisconsin, they might think of the cheese and milk. They might think of the beer and maybe cranberries. How big a deal are potatoes here in the state?
Yeah, so that was a surprise to me. I did not realize that that Wisconsin is the third largest producers of potatoes in the country. So they're a big deal. Now, they're kind of concentrated to a pretty small section of the state in the Central Sands. But again, we produce, you know, we're the third largest producer of potatoes in the country.
And when we look at potatoes in that Central Sands area, that's an important part of the story, right? Mm-hmm. The landscape, the geology, set the scene for us before we get into the climate change part of the story.
Yeah, that's kind of key because in the Central Sands, as its name implies, it's a light, sandy soil, right? Which makes it really good for growing potatoes because potatoes are kind of a finicky crop, right? They need a lot of water and they need a lot of nutrients, but they're also prone to rot and disease. So if they sit in water, that's a problem. And the sandy soil water just kind of washes right through it. But like I said earlier, potatoes really need a lot of nutrients to grow, which means nitrogen. And nitrogen, it leaks through that sandy soil really easily, and then that can become a problem because it contaminates the groundwater.
Right. We hear a lot about nitrates ending up in people's wells. Is this a concern in the Central Sands area in this potato growing zone?
It is. It's a big concern. You know, state agencies estimate about 10% of Wisconsin private wells are above the standard for nitrate contamination. So it's, you know, it's kind of a small area of the state, but it's a big deal in that area.
We hear about nitrate pollution in a lot of parts of the state. Is the Central Sands like a particularly big nitrate problem, or is it just it's its own local version of a statewide problem?
So it is a statewide problem. Nitrates are the largest contaminant in the state, but it's a particular issue in the Central Sands because of that soil type, right? It really just doesn't hold on to water and that nutrient. So once it gets below that first level of topsoil, it's lost, right? And that is a big deal. And that's particularly a big deal with potatoes because they have a really shallow root system, so they don't hold on to the nitrogen that well. And that you know, that's going to become a bigger problem because of climate change. So, you know, the farmers that I talk to, they have to be really careful not to spray nitrogen and put a lot out when they know that there's going to be a big rainfall event. And what are we seeing more with climate change is increases in extreme rainfalls.
Mary Kate McCoy is with us, WPR digital content producer. We're talking about her new On the Table series, looking at the impact of climate change on some of Wisconsin's iconic foods. Right now, we're focusing on potatoes here in one part of the state. Mary Kate, you were just setting the stage for me there. You gave us the background on potatoes. Now, climate change and more extreme weather events, how does that change the situation?
So, yeah, the big concern with climate change is the intense rainfalls that are happening, right? So the water, like I mentioned earlier, it's a sandy soil. It just washes right through the soil. And the more intense the rain, the more likely it is for the nitrate to kind of to leak through. So, like, for example, Wisconsin's average rainfall is roughly 32 inches every year. The last few years, we've been pushing about 40 inches. And that's a big deal when it comes to nitrate contamination and kind of trying to keep that nitrogen in the soil. Another like kind of aspect of climate change with nitrogen and potato growing is that growing seasons are getting longer. So that means more nitrogen. That means, you know, that's being applied. So like that's in some ways that's good for potato growing. It's going to make managing nitrogen a little bit more difficult. And another kind of area of growing research with nitrogen management in the area is the amount of nitrogen that's lost outside of the growing season. So as we get more precipitation outside of just, you know, the summer and when these potatoes are growing, like that's going to become a bigger issue and harder to keep it in the soil. And that's particularly true because there's no crops in the ground at that time for a lot of farms, right? So there's not a plant that's really soaking up that nitrogen.
You also looked at possible ways to adapt to the situation when it comes to nitrates and potato and this kind of soil. What kind of solutions are people putting out there?
Yeah, so like I was just saying before with like nitrogen leaking outside of the growing season, cover crops are a really good way of managing that. So that's one area that people are, you know, trying to do more of to try to kind of soak up again that nitrogen. Researchers talk over and over about how important it is to diversify a farm too, right? So we're not just growing potatoes. We're not just growing cranberries or whatever. So like if a climate change event an extreme weather event were to happen, like what kind of do we have a diverse farm that we can rely or we can fall back on another crop if it affects potatoes in particular?
Is there anything about the kinds of potatoes we grow and then eat?
Yeah, so potatoes are interesting because they require their range is really large, I should say. Some potatoes require a lot of nitrogen. Others don't require very much. Unfortunately, some of the most commonly grown potato varieties in Wisconsin require the most amount of nitrogen. So that's like one thing that's come up with some of the farmers that I spoke to is, you know, we have potato varieties that need less nitrogen than others. Our customers don't want those varieties more often than not.
And when we talk customers, that's us cooking at home, but also I imagine the people making things like French fries?
Exactly.
Yeah, so what's the French fry potato of choice? Is it just that russet I can pick up at the store?
Yep, it's a russet Burbank, right? So, and the russet Burbank is a potato variety that's kind of used across the board in other big potato growing states as well. It's not particularly well suited for Wisconsin, though, with our like kind of our humid nights, right, and our just the more moisture that we get. And it's about a 50 or 60 year old variety.
You also talked to some experts about the possibility of genetically modified potato crops. That's been controversial, of course, over the years. But what kind of things did they say about why that might be useful?
Yeah, so they talk a lot about trying to develop varieties that need less nitrogen, for one, and less water. And they also talk a lot about how can we, you know, breed a variety of potato that can better withstand some of these intense events that are going to happen with more frequency with climate change, so that can handle a little bit more water, that can be drought stressed, for example.
And getting back to the diversification idea, one crop that I don't think of at all as a Wisconsin crop, kidney beans could be part of the answer here?
Yeah, that's right. That's just one example that researchers are working with farmers to adopt. And the kidney bean, one reason, there are a few reasons why they're doing that is, one, it has a high value, and two and three, it uses less water and it uses less nitrogen.
Is that something that farmers are picking up now, or are we just kind of experimenting here?
We're in the experimental phase right now, but it's certainly something that farmers and researchers are looking to.
Now, you've done this research on potatoes and five other food products. Do you think differently when you're at the grocery store now looking at these things on the shelves?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do. You know, you just think about where does this food come from and, you know, what went into growing it.
And I see sometimes there are these cool heirloom potatoes out there. Do you have you branched out and tried experimenting with different colors and flavors of potatoes?
You know, I haven't, but I think I'll have to.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to having you on Food Friday next time.
All right. Thank you.
Mary Kate, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's WPR digital content producer Mary Kate McCoy. We talked to her today about the impact of climate change on Wisconsin's potato farming business. That story is part of a series she produced called On the Table that looks at climate change affecting iconic Wisconsin food products. She also goes into cranberries, beer, dairy, and more. You can read the whole series online. Check it out at WPR.org/table. People in Madison are called Madisonians, and Milwaukee has Milwaukeeans, but not every community has a commonly used name for its residents. But as of last week, one more place in Wisconsin does have one. As reported in the Green Bay Press Gazette, last week the Village Board of Alloway approved a resolution creating the official designation for village residents. This is a name that throws some people off. It's spelled Alloways, but pronounced Alloway. Now, if you live there, you are an Alloweian. The silent Z does stay in. There was some back and forth on that. Alloweian. The resolution references the village's founding by Father Claude Alloway in 1669. That name is already taking off. Apparently, the Zambaldi Beer Company has created what they're calling the Alloweian Belgian Pale Ale. I also learned while looking into this, there's a name for that kind of name, Alloweian or Milwaukeean or whatever. It's called a demonym or demonym. I should have looked up the pronunciation of that, but that is the official word for, you know, Wisconsinite, or when I was a kid, there was a debate in my home state of Michigan, Michiganian or Michigander. I think there was a vote on it, too. Michigander, I think, won. I don't know if anybody actually says that anymore, though. Does your town have a demonym? Demonym? What do you call people from your community? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. We are Central Timeians here on Wisconsin Public Radio.